This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 27th of July 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound. It's question time on the Culture Show, of course, and this week we're asking, how do you make a myth? Myths are like history, only they're not real, but they're reasonable, kind of. You can see why in the beginning there might have been a couple in a garden running around in the nude, and not just in Christianity, but in Japan, for example, and elsewhere too. Like Fox Mulder in The X-Files, as human beings, we want to believe. We're going to try and tackle this one with a tool of many prongs. We'll be speaking to a classicist to ask why myths still appeal. We'll be asking an art historian where paintings would be without myth. And we'll be asking cultural commentator Peter York, what makes a modern myth?
The obvious mythological person, the mythological creature, would probably be somebody with an element of changeableness and withdrawal. Sudden disappearances.
All right, that's How Do You Make a Myth, right here on Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. We're going to attack this show in a sort of chronological order, so where better to begin than with ancient Greek myths? Whether it's Daedalus and Icarus, Aphrodite and Adonis, or even Pandora's Box, everyone knows these stories, or at least a version of them, as they've been passed on and adapted over thousands of years. We've invited classicist, writer and broadcaster Natalie Haynes into the studio to set these stories up for us and tell us what their enduring appeal is. Talking about myths on this show, we're asking generally the question, how do you make a myth?
The Greeks are almost always, you know, responsible. And generally when things sound odd, it's because of a mistranslation. So Pandora doesn't have a box. In fact, she has a jar.
Oh, really?
Yeah, okay. It's one of those great kind of accusations. I always feel a bit sorry for Pandora because she kind of sounds like an idiot because she's given a box and they say, definitely don't open the box. And she goes, oh, clearly I'm demented. I'll just open the box and then everything comes out except blah, blah, blah. But a box sounds like it might contain something terrible, doesn't it? Whereas a jar sounds extremely, that's just food or drink. It's wine or oil or a jar is something which could intrinsically be broken. It always strikes me that she's been poorly treated with the mistranslation of pithos, I think is the word in Greek.
There are so many connections, presumably, between some of the idioms we use in everyday language and the stories that we tell and the structure of those stories that go right back to Greek myth.
Absolutely.
And you've written about this, and I wondered what, you know, whether it is about story structure, and, you know, they always say that there's only sort of seven stories in the world.
Sometimes it's a different number. It's always a prime number, though, to give it mysticism.
Yes, exactly. But where do these stories go back to? What are the ones for you that are completely enduring, whether they're quest or whether they are odyssey? What are the kind of enduring theme?
If you look at their very origins, it's almost always, we're always trying to make sense. Humanity has always tried to make sense of its environs. And if you look at how myths build, especially with gods, it's almost always a case of people trying to explain the inexplicable given the available information that they have. So, for example, to the Greeks and the Romans, earthquakes are caused by Poseidon or Neptune, depending on how late you are, with his trident under the sea, bang, and then earthquake. And that sounds like, to us, that sounds demented. But of course, there was no possible way you could tell that there were tectonic plates. You could tell the difference between land and ocean. You couldn't possibly have guessed that there was then a whole sub-level of things far beyond where you could ever see. You couldn't get down and look. You had no hope of being able to scuba dive. I mean, all of those things were impossible. So they made a reasonable conclusion given the available information. There was definitely a time when the earth shook. And it makes more sense, doesn't it? If you're on ground level and somebody stamps their foot on a wooden floor, you know that's what happens. It makes sense that it's somebody angry. And so they may seem irrational, but actually they're usually quite good, if naive, ways of trying to understand the natural world. And so it makes sense that Zeus strikes us with thunderbolts when he's angry, but it would be a mistake to think that the Greeks didn't question that. There's a lovely bit in The Clouds, in Aristophanes' comic play The Clouds, where Socrates, or at least a version of Socrates, to do him his credit, suggests that it's impossible that thunder is caused by Zeus, because Zeus uses his thunderbolts to strike perjurers. That's very important. Of course, in a pre-written society, in an oral society, then not keeping your word is horrific.
Your word is your bond, and that is
absolutely broken, is. When Euripides says in the Hippolytus, when he says, my tongue swore, my mind was unsworn. This is so shocking that Aristophanes quotes it over and over again for decades to come in his plays. So in a pre-written society, the idea of perjury is terrible. So you need a punishment system in place. People need to be able to believe that perjurers, that people who swear falsely will be punished. But even then, even in the 5th century, Socrates in the play The Clouds is saying, well, you know, but what about when thunder strikes that oak tree? Are you saying that an oak tree committed perjury? Okay, well, what about when thunder strikes the Temple of Zeus? Are you saying that the Temple of Zeus is now profaned before Zeus?
And logic and reason has to be unfolded from these things.
Absolutely.
It started off as myth, started off as saying sorry to the angry gods or trying to placate them.
Absolutely. Yeah. So it makes perfect sense they would come in that way. And then because these stories are so brilliant, they have stuck with us ever since. And the most obvious recent example has been the Greek crisis, where time without number, reports on it have used Greek myth. So they've gone for, they're opening a Pandora's box.
Yeah.
They've gone with beware Greeks bearing gifts. There could be more Greek tragedy to come. They have every single time gone for it. Of course, when they say beware Greeks bearing gifts, they probably don't know. I hesitate to discredit all journalists, but they probably don't know. It comes from the Aeneid. So
right. It's
technically a Roman version of a Greek myth. And it's Aeneas explaining how the Trojan horse ends up inside their city.
As we come to the end of wondering how myths are made with you, Natalie, I wonder whether in the time when myths were being created, in the time that you're talking about, in the time of the ancient Greeks, whether there were myths before that, if you know what I mean. I mean, if this was reason and logic and this was discourse and this was considered to be cause and effect, this is where the myth making came from, whether there was anything before that. I wonder if the Greeks wrote about myths as we write about the myths of the Greeks.
Well, I think the problem there is that writing doesn't exist until after these myths exist. So that makes it a little harder. So they have to wait till the Phoenicians come along to swipe the alphabet, because the Greeks, if nothing else, are the most brilliant magpies. And
yeah.
So they get ideas for alphabets and money from all their trading. And so I guess the short answer is kind of who knows, but there are definitely parallels. If you look at how particular religious stories exist that come from completely different cultures and yet are oddly parallel. So, for example, the goddess Isis in Egyptian religion has a husband, Osiris, and he is killed, and she has to collect he's dismembered, I think, and cut into tiny pieces, and she collects up the pieces, and then he can be rejuvenated, he can be born again.
Right.
And obviously,
the stuff of science fiction.
Yeah, but I am not a religious person. So to me, I can't help but see the parallels with the idea of a son of God dying and being born again in Christianity. I appreciate that other people feel very differently about it, but it seems to me undeniable that those stories come out
of
quite different
cultures.
There are
echoes and links across these things. And it's interesting that we found in another conversation that there's a Garden of Eden type of story in ancient Japanese civilization as well. There's an Adam and Eve, you know,
Absolutely.
And all the rest of it. And it's a funny thing, you know, I guess we, irrespective of where we come from in the world, whether it's desert or forest or hilltop or vale, that you need these same things to believe in where you came from, I suppose.
I think that's true. I think there are certain tropes, for sure. I don't know how many stories there are, but there are definitely tropes that appear over and over
again. By the time we finish
this
chat, someone will have changed
it. Someone will have changed it.
Yeah.
So you get those kind of tropes. Like a maze is a really common paradise, for sure. But a maze is a constant. You know, you find it over and over again of having to go into a maze and come out again. And those stories, there are various different types of kind of journey, aren't there? There's a quest where you have to go and find a thing, an odyssey where you have to come home again, and a maze where you go in and come out again. And Alice in Wonderland is the most obvious of those, I guess, where you have to go in, puzzle your way through and come out. It has to serve a metaphorical purpose, doesn't it? That we all can somehow sense. We know there are times when we feel utterly baffled and that we can't see a way forward, and yet we kind of move through life trusting that we'll come out again. And I think those kinds of stories exist because everyone feels like that to a greater or lesser extent. Most of us have those experiences.
And that was the ever erudite Natalie Haynes there, whose new book is The Amber Fury, which is a novel but very heavily based on Greek myth. Now today we're asking, how do you make a myth? We've heard from Natalie Haynes, august scholar with an eagle eye on the contemporary that she is. Now we're going to speak to an art historian who's in love with the romance of myth and has written a new book called simply Mythology. It's a nice big Thames and Hudson illustrated jobby with chapters titled Gifts from the Gods and Symbolic Substances. It's a lush thing. I spoke to Christopher on the line from Amsterdam.
We create stories about where we come from. I mean, I think that's the most kind of primordial thing, right? And it's the first question in everybody's head, like, where do we come from? Why is the world the way it is? Why is the universe the way it is? Why are the stars in the sky? Why does the sun rise, or apparently rise, every day. Why are animals the way they are? If you think back to, I know, say my childhood, the kind of, you have the wonderful kind of Just So stories, it's exactly the same thing. It's these fundamental questions, just why are things the way they are? And why do good things happen? Why do bad things happen?
And for you, Christopher, putting this book together, I mean, was it finding some of the reason in mythology, or were you more attracted to the romance of it? I mean, your book is set out into quite reasonable chapters. If we think of symbolic substances, you've got a chapter on gold, milk, blood, salt, etc., etc. You've got heroes, you've got humankind, you've got the supernatural realm. There's all these things. Were you attracted, I suppose, originally to write this book out of a great romantic attraction towards mythology, or did you want to sort of trace back the reason of humanity?
I suppose I'm interested in the romantic side. I'm specifically interested in human imagination, because what I see in this, this book is a compendium of fantastic ideas that apparently explain why the world is the way it is, but actually a lot of the time doesn't explain it at all in terms of our kind of modern scientific understanding of how things work. But we still cling to this imagination. We still create myths today. And I do think there's something utterly irrepressible in the human mind that just kind of wants to invent backstories, that wants to make things, to be frank, more interesting than they actually are.
And there's a great wealth of pictures in your book. I mean, this is an amazing piece of research, I suppose, in itself, doing the picture research for your book. Where on earth would art be? I mean, if we're thinking in terms of everything from cave paintings to, you also feature Paul Gauguin, where on earth would art be without mythology?
Absolutely nowhere. It's a great, great question. It really kind of cuts to the heart of it. I'm an art historian myself, so originally I studied at the Courtauld Institute and then worked in the National Gallery. So I suppose I'm extremely passionate about the images. And in fact, that for me, in making any book, the really exciting part is just finding really kind of interesting images that simply haven't been seen by people before, that don't appear in books. Of course, there's no question whatsoever that if you think of the transition, say, from the kind of medieval painter to the Renaissance painter, the medieval painter, they're very into the kind of crucifixions, and you have the saints. And you get to the Renaissance and the unlocking of classical mythology, and suddenly there's this incredible explosion of kind of artistic endeavor and creativity that then results, of course, in the wonderful works by, you know, Botticelli. You have the Birth of Venus, you have the Primavera, but of course everything, you know, all the wonderful Bellinis, the Titians, the Michelangelos, they're all mining into this incredible creative force that there is locked up in these stories.
There's quite a lot of Gothic in that, isn't there? What we understand as the Gothic in that sort of rebirth of kind of classical myth. And I wonder what you thought about that, whether you thought there was a kind of golden age for the retelling of these mythologies, Christopher.
I think there's no question, if we think of the kind of birth of Gothic as we understand it in the West, so this is, say, the kind of late 18th century, early 19th century, there's a darkness there, which of course is fascinated and attracted to the monstrous, shall we say, the inexplicable. And actually we see this continue then through the 19th century. It's interesting, actually, there are so many foundational myths. If we look at, for example, say, Scandinavian countries, if we look at even Germany to a certain extent, which are really kind of, they're revived and given new life entirely in the 19th century, and of course then really kind of play out in the 20th century.
Without having to kill any darlings in the process, Christopher, what some of your favourite ones are? I mean, I'm intrigued to learn, reading your book, that we have Adam and Eve, you know, in Christianity, and the Japanese have exactly the same sort of first two people on earth kind of myth as well. Did you find sort of crossovers, and did you find any particular favourites that sort of jumped out in your research for writing this book?
So I think the book is all about crossovers for me. When I was originally looking at kind of everything that was on the market, of course, it's a subject which has attracted publishers for many, many years. I wanted to do something different, and I wanted to do something that really kind of appealed to the way my brain works, which is to look for patterns. So what I wanted to do was, instead of kind of going through culture by culture or over time, which is the conventional way of looking at mythology, to actually look for patterns, which is a fairly Jungian thing to do, actually. You mentioned Jung earlier, and I think that's the sort of thing he would have loved. So I'm looking for repetition. So we get, for example, floods, flood mythologies. You find it all sorts of different parts of the world. So you'll find it in Japan. You'll find the myth of a flood, obviously, in the Old Testament. But, of course, you'll also find it in ancient Mesopotamia. You'll also find it in Native American mythology. I love also the way that we find, say, twins in lots of different parts of the world. So you'll find twins appear in Mayan mythology, Again, you'll find them in Yoruba mythology, for example, in Nigeria. But of course, you'll also find it in Cain and Abel. And you'll also find it in Castor and Pollux in classical mythology. By the way, Cain and Abel weren't twins.
And just finally, Christopher, is there ever a bad time to publish a book about mythology? Obviously, these stories go back into the mists of time, the mists before the mists of time. Is there any reason why the book comes out this year in the middle of the year?
I don't think there's ever a bad time to go back and revisit these fantastic stories because they're just such great fun. I mean, I'd recommend to anyone they pick up a copy of, you know, the Odyssey, that they pick up a copy of the Nordic Edda, for example. I mean, these are just really great, engrossing stories and really good stories that tackle, I suppose, what it is to be human. If you look at classical mythology, it's all the same things that actually kind of preoccupy us day to day. They're stories of love and hate and of jealousies and of people acting, even gods acting in a really irrational way. I think being human kind of never goes out of fashion. And I think humans wanting to understand what it is that makes us human never goes out of fashion. So I think it's always a great time to talk about mythology.
That was writer and art historian Christopher Dell, and his book Mythology: An Illustrated Journey into Our Imagined Worlds is out on the 17th of August, published by Thames and Hudson. After the break, more myths, from mysterious celebrities to spooky supernatural sightings. Stick around.
Do you ever feel like you've missed out on something? Have you been on the road? Miss the latest world news? Then catch up with The Recap. The best of the week's cutting-edge reports, comment, news and features from all the flagship shows on Monocle 24. Join us every Saturday from 1400 London time or via the Monocle 24 app.
You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. In this second part of the show, we're going to concentrate on how myths are constructed in modern society. We're going to begin with a few of the stranger urban legends. Dr. David Clark is a journalist for the Fortean Times, a monthly UK-based publication which deals with spooky sightings, unnatural beasts, and other strange phenomena. Each day he receives all sorts of bizarre stories, but how do you separate the legends from the hoaxes, and how do you know which stories could become a good modern myth? Producer Holly found out when she spoke to Dr. Clark.
I think what becomes quite clear is that people have extraordinary experiences, and they always have had. You know, I mean, even like you go back into the Bible stories, and you see stories about like the prophet Ezekiel who had the vision of angels and a fiery chariot. Most religions of the world are based upon people having these kinds of experiences, but there are also people, the ones that are probably less reliable, where someone has obviously been influenced by an existing story. You know, they've got their head full of science fiction and they've watched The X-Files, and they go outside and they see a light moving around in the sky, and suddenly that light turns into some fantastic spaceship. There are people who have genuine unexplained experiences, and I do actually think those experiences are real, but they're real in terms of they happen inside that person's head. They're not. If you were standing next to them when they're having the experience, you'd probably see nothing unusual.
So stories like this, they really sort of blur the lines between fact and fiction. So how do you approach writing about them?
You have to write about them very carefully because there is this sort of schism that you find in the literature of the subject, in that you get very uncritical writers. You walk into any Waterstones on the high street, go to the mind, body and spirit section, and you can find any number of books on angels, on aliens, on all kinds of weird and supernatural things, which are totally uncritical, which are just, they just take things as being literal, as being true. Because someone appears to be genuine or something is possible, then it's true, you know, with as little evidence as possible. Because a lot of those sort of writers just, I don't know, whether they're writing for money or whether they actually genuinely believe this stuff, but they don't actually apply any critical faculties to it. And then you get the opposite extreme, which are the extreme debunkers, the people like Richard Dawkins, who just say all these kinds of beliefs and superstitions and legendary material is just nonsense. It's just humans sort of reverting back to the sort of superstitious past, and now that we're all educated and we've got science as our new religion, you know, we really should be sort of exposing all this for the nonsense that it is. And as a folklorist, I don't accept either of those approaches. I think all these stories are interesting because of what they tell us about human beings.
What sorts of stories or what elements in stories do you think then get picked up, and what elements create a good urban myth, basically?
Well, that's a very good question. In the stories that survive are the ones that are good stories. That's the simplest way of putting it, because, you know, there are millions, literally millions of different stories and traditions. I mean, and whoever you are, wherever you live on the planet, you will have some sort of story that you will remember from childhood or whatever about a certain place near where you were born, where there was a haunting, or a certain place where your mum told you you shouldn't go because there's nasty things lurking there, or stories about places, you know, a place that's said to be where Robin Hood fired an arrow or something of that kind. There are all kinds of stories and legends that have come down to us through the ages, and it's the ones that are the most psychologically appealing and the ones that have a good narrative structure, you know, where there's a twist at the end, like in urban legends, where there's some kind of story that's set up and there's a resolution at the end that sort of makes you sit up and think or gasp in horror. They're the kinds of stories that stick in people's minds, and they get repeated and they get retold and recycled and that live on for decades and centuries.
What's your favourite modern myth that you've heard?
the one I really like, and again, this is one that stuck in my mind because it's one I heard when I was a younger newspaper reporter working in South Yorkshire, was one about a painting called The Crying Boy. And it was a very cheap, mass-produced painting that apparently came from an anonymous painter in, I think it was either Italy or Spain in the 1970s, and hundreds if not thousands of these paintings were sold in Woolworth's department store. And everybody in the north of England had lots of families had these paintings on the wall, and it was of a small child with very large eyes who appeared to be crying, so, hence The Crying Boy. And some people hated the picture, others loved it, and thousands of people had this painting. And then suddenly in the 1980s, in Rotherham, which is where I was working as a journalist, this story got round that firemen had been called out to very severe fires in various houses, and where the plaster had fallen off the wall, the heat had been so intense. And the only thing that had survived in the structure of the house was this particular painting of this small boy crying. So obviously this legend got round, and it actually made the front page of The Sun, and they ran this as the curse of the crying boy. Have you got one of these paintings on your wall? If you have, send it to us and we'll burn it for you. The Sun burnt them on a huge bonfire. And that story was created by the tabloids, and when you actually spoke to the firemen, they said, well, the reason the painting didn't burn is because it had been made on a sort of a fire-resistant hardboard. So that was the simple solution, but people don't like simple solutions. They like the idea that there's some kind of evil spirit hiding in the painting that burns houses down. And that story was created by the tabloids and long, long ago. But if you go on the internet now and type in crying boy, these paintings now are all over the world. And the legend has sort of migrated onto the internet. And the reason is because it's such an interesting story. It's such a good story. And it's a story that's perfect for transmission online.
That was journalist at the 14 Times, Dr. David Clark, speaking to Holly Fisher. Watch out for that spooky crying boy. We said that we were going to do this chronologically, so here we are. We've ended up in the modern day to discuss how to turn a person into a myth. The most alluring celebrities aren't those splashed across gossip websites or the front pages of newspapers, but it's those who pop up from nowhere and then disappear into the ether in a puff of shimmering smoke. They don't reveal too much and have an air of mystery which makes them addictively puzzling. Cultural commentator Peter York joins me in the studio to tell me who the most successful real-life myths of our time might well be.
I think the obvious mythological person, the mythological creature, would probably be somebody with an element of changeableness and withdrawal, sudden disappearances. So David Bowie is very mythological in every way because he is recreated and then he disappears from view and the whole thing is done by proxies and exhibitions and so on. So that's got mythological status, and it's got a backstory, it's got artisticism. You know, now it helps to have a bit of artisticism and a bit of the other thing as well. So there's a mythological beast.
He's almost like something from classical allegory, isn't he, David
yes.
Bowie? I mean, he's kind of, I suppose he's a classic myth and a self-invention as well.
And yes, self-invention. Now, in that, because of the change in media and the mechanism of myth-making, people are consciously seeking to make myths as a job. You know, can I have two myths by tomorrow morning? It's all right, sir.
Can you wrap them up in a brown paper bag?
My fantastically banal client mythological, or, to use the awful words, legendary, iconic, etc., national treasure. All these things are sort of sub. Yeah. It's the diffusion version of a myth.
What's the advantage in being a myth? I mean, whether you're a pop star, whether you are a brand of luxury sports car, whether you are a book that's out of print, I wonder what the advantage
is. The advantage ought to be big advances. You've got a book and a very highly cranked deal. If you're a myth, you ought to get a better crank in your deal. Your agent ought to be able to extract the first time anyway, when you're 90, a very, very good deal.
What time would a myth leave a party?
Well, leave him wanting more.
Yeah.
Leave him wanting more. Was he there? I went to view for my friend Dexter Dalwood.
Oh, yeah.
The British artist who was a punk. Was a member of the Cortinas in his time.
Ah.
Dexter Dalwood.
When I met him, he was wearing DMs.
Very likely. Mm. Dexter Dalwood, and at his view in Mayfair, I thought, is that person Malcolm Gladwell? Could he be Malcolm Gladwell? And he was gone in a puff. But he had Malcolm Gladwell type hair.
Did he?
Yes.
The Phil Spector full on.
The full on.
The Beethoven.
Yes.
Yes. It's true, isn't it? Okay, so there's something of the myth in that.
Yes.
You know.
Yes.
Is it a bird? Is it a plane? Is it Malcolm Gladwell? Oh, he's vanished before I could ask him.
Yes.
Yeah. Just finally, running back to mythology, we talked about the people that kind of peddle mythology. Is this branding agencies? Is this modern advertising agencies? Do the people and the brands that are successfully mythological, do they do it all themselves? Can mythological tactics be learnt and taught, I wonder?
Yes, of course. Absolutely. They may be found out, but of course they can be learned. And what if you persuaded on behalf, client is too bad a word, on behalf of the interest you are representing, to get somebody very, very persuasive to write a defining essay that wasn't necessarily a profile, nothing as crass as that, but put your interest as the really fascinating background figure, you know. You'd think, oh, you know, and then you'd hear it again from another thing, and the mythological drumbeat would be going in your head. It's doable. It's all doable.
And that was Peter York bringing us to the end of this week's show. So how do you make a myth? Well, you need mystery, you need an idea of the elemental, you need a bit of scarcity, you need people to believe in you most of all. And maybe, just maybe, an outfit that consists mainly of robes. You've been listening to Culture on Monocle 24. My producer was the legendary Holly Fisher. Join us again at the same time next week. But for the time being, I've been Robert Bound. Thank you very much for tuning in.